BDNG podcast. My name is Tina McKenzie and I am the Education Development Lead for the BDNG. I hope you enjoy listening to the BDNG podcast and find them beneficial to your practice. These podcasts are sponsored by Amaril. Amaril has no influence over the content of these podcasts. Happy listening. Welcome everybody to another BDNG podcast. My name is Tina McKenzie and I am the Education and Development Lead for the BDNG, and I also work clinically as a nurse consultant. So today we have Fran Roberts with us, who I am very delighted is on this podcast today, and her focus is going to be on anxiety and self-care. So welcome, Fran, to this podcast. Very good to meet you via podcast world. And could you just maybe introduce yourself and just tell us a bit of background?
Yes. Hi, Tina. Thank you. Yes. So I'm Fran. I'm an integrative psychotherapist. I've been practicing for about 16 years, but I did my degree in psychology back in 1997. So a long, long time ago now. But yeah, I've been practicing as a therapist for about 16 years. And for the last decade, probably at least, I've been focusing on anxiety and self-care.
Fantastic. And yeah, time flies, doesn't it, when we're having fun? Definitely. I can't believe I've been in nursing for so long either. Absolutely. So anxiety is definitely on the increase, I think. You know, personally, I see a lot more when it comes to patients. They do speak a lot about it a lot more as well. And it does affect so many people, you know, in everyday life. And I think if we're all honest with ourselves as well, we all have some levels of anxiety as well. And could you just tell the listeners today just a bit more about, you know, how you became involved with this particular topic and what work are you doing towards this?
Yeah, absolutely. So I sort of first encountered it in my practice, probably quite early on. And I realized quite quickly that I didn't really understand it, and I was finding that I would help a client kind of come through it, and we'd find this sort of revelation and they'd feel peace, and then 2 weeks later it would fly back in 10 times harder, and I couldn't work out why. And when I was looking into it, I couldn't really find clear information on how to work with it and what to do. There's obviously lots of different approaches, so I just became very fascinated myself in how to understand it, and obviously now sort of 15 years later, I feel like I've got a good grip on it. It's become a bit of a passion, really. And so my understanding, I think, sort of at the moment, and it's always evolving, really, is that I think there's kind of three strands. And we're looking at, I've sort of come up with a little theory called the Xbox theory. I'm not sure if we can use Xbox, but we will for now. And so I think everybody's got an Xbox, and that's everything from the neck down. That's the console. That's the physical experience of, we'll call it panic, stress and anxiety. So that fight or flight feeling, and that's the sweaty palms, that's the heart racing, that's the physical feeling we have. But then there's three games that we play, and we've got panic, stress and anxiety. Panic is the game you play in the moment. So it could be fleeing a burning building. It could be sitting down to do an exam. It could be walking onto a sports pitch. Your body goes into that sort of fight, flight place, and your mind sort of brings up the threat. And you find a solution. And once the threat has been resolved, the body calms down, the game is finished. And then game two is stress. And that's kind of the long-term game. So we're thinking about preparing for an exam or a meeting or learning your lines for a play, doing something in the future that requires you to do something now to make sure that you're prepared. And that I would call is a stress game. And again, once the game has been completed, once the stress is over, the game will end, the body returns to normal. And then you have anxiety. And anxiety, I sort of think, is a little bit of a sneak. It's snuck in, and it's basically stolen the Xbox, the game, the console, the feelings, but it's brought up a fake threat. So it's what if? What if I go to that party and no one likes me? What if I fail and I lose my job? Or what if, what if, what if? And in the moment, there's nothing you can do. But the game is still trying to be played. So in that moment, what happens is the body goes into fight or flight, the game gets triggered, and then you get caught because there is no solution to a fake threat. And that's where anxiety becomes a problem, because each time you try and find a solution, it weaves itself back in. Ah, but what if? Ah, but what if? Which then confirms that this is a real problem and it's unsolvable, and we get stuck. So my theory is that we if once you know you're playing anxiety, you don't play the game, you basically learn how to turn the Xbox off. But you turn it off at source by not playing the game. So that could be through meditation, mindfulness, breath work. It's through distraction, not avoidance, but distraction in the moment. So there's lots of tools and techniques you can do in that moment to calm the Xbox down.
Absolutely love how you've explained that. That's fantastic. I love that Xbox. That is absolutely fantastic, and it just makes total sense how you've explained all that. Absolutely.
Bad.
Yeah, but no, it's crazy. Yeah. It really did resonate with my brain. Definitely, you've definitely engaged something there, and yeah, I love how you've explained that. I guess when you're seeing, you know, your particular clients as well, are they sort of at the whole level of, you know, sort of more what we would sort of say severe anxiety, you know, they've lost that game kind of scenario?
Generally, yeah. And often what happens when people develop anxiety is that they start to play multiple games. So it could be planes, trains, it could be food, it could be a whole variety of things, and all the games are kind of playing in different places. And what we tend to try and do is look at each game and try and figure out how to win it, and that's ultimately only going to figure out that game. What we want to do is always go back to source and learn how to calm the body down so the game can't even be started. So yeah,
and it is that sort of distraction, like you mentioned. And having seen patients, you know, and people with anxiety, sometimes, you know, there's no sort of right or reason for it. You know, you are personally saying, why are you feeling like that? But that person is just so out of control sometimes with the anxiety, you know, and it's just really difficult to switch it off, isn't it? So
absolutely. It's like that, you know, the love letter I wrote.
I love it. Yeah.
Yeah, which is about, because what I see a lot with clients is they totally believe, understandably, what the anxiety is saying. They have faith in it. I'm scared. There's a threat. It must be real. So I'm going to believe what it's saying. And that sort of letter I wrote, which is the love letter from anxiety to the mind, is just showing you that kind of toxic relationship where it's saying, I'm here to help, but I'm not. So you help people understand that this anxiety, because it's using the fight or flight mechanism, you know, which is our survival response, and we are designed not to override that. So it's incredibly hard once it kicks in for us to notice it and say, actually, no, this isn't real. I don't need to take it seriously.
It's very, very difficult sometimes, isn't it? And just to explain a little bit more about your love letter, because I had the privilege of reading this love letter, and it's absolutely fantastic work that you have done. I know you've mentioned it there, but could you just explain to our listeners just a bit more about the love letter and the meaning behind it?
Yes. So, as I said, it came off the back of seeing time and time and time again clients coming in and wanting to hold on to their anxiety, wanting to keep it because it was what kept them safe. And suddenly realizing that there was this, what I consider to be a toxic love relationship between the person and the anxiety. So I decided to write a letter from anxiety to the mind, showing people how it talks to you, how it lures you in, how it keeps you wrapped up and sort of keeps your attention. But ultimately then how you then potentially start to realize that you can step away from it. Just to kind of help people understand the relationship they're having with it, and why they feel so compelled by it, but also why they shouldn't be compelled by it.
I think that's another great explanation, you know, that relationship with anxiety, because it's quite distressing to see somebody with anxiety and, you know, it's got that hold of them. And as I say, you know, to others looking in, there's no sort of explanation, but to that person, it means, you know, they cannot switch off. So I think, you know, what you've described there is so real. And also it's a really good way of explaining it to, you know, people that maybe see somebody with anxiety that's a bit more out of control for the first time. So thank you for that, Fran. So obviously you see a lot of people and you're absolutely fantastic at your role. I know that. And the fact is, if say I was coming in for my very first appointment and you know, I have this anxiety, and how do you go about realizing what is going to be suitable for that person in front of you? Because I maybe not like mindfulness, you know, I've tried it, load of rubbish, you know, but I maybe love mindfulness. So how do you, you know, treat that individual in front of you?
Well, so every client is different. I remember the first day of my psychology degree, the lecturer saying, the reason why psychology isn't a science is because A plus B never equals C. And I love that. So the first session is always an assessment, and I find out a little bit more about the history of their anxiety, when it started, if there was a trigger at the beginning. There sometimes isn't an obvious one, but also to try and understand them and what they've tried before, if they've tried anything. A big part of what I do with clients is psychological education. So I like to explain to them my understanding of anxiety, what it is, how it works in the body. I think the more information we have, the easier it is to take steps in the direction that is helpful. And then we figure out a toolbox, really, of how to help them through it. Everybody's different. So, again, depending on how long they've had the anxiety, what it is, where it stemmed from, the type of person that they are, will depend on the approach that we end up taking. And it sort of varies. But as a general rule, if we can get them into mindfulness, whether it's, if it's not meditation, you know, anxiety is future based. So if we can keep someone in the present moment and grounded in the present moment, anxiety can't exist. So, you know, there's lots of different techniques we can do for that. Like we said, you know, distraction, you know, doctors and nurses use it when someone's traumatized and they just chat to them about life. So what have you been up to? Bringing someone into the moment away from where their mind has taken them. But there's also breath work. We can do breathing exercises, which lots of people find more straightforward because it's something to engage with. So as again, as I said, it really does depend from client to client how you approach it with them.
Absolutely. So you're assessing that client from early stages, definitely. Yeah. And I've actually just been writing an article this morning on breath work. There's so much information out there because I do go to breathe classes because I enjoy it and it's something I love. And the fact is that, you know, we do have to focus definitely in the NHS, not just on our patients, but ourselves as well. So the more you read about breath work, it's such a great thing for anxiety and stress. It's just fascinating.
It really is. You know, we know that the parasympathetic nervous system, which is the calming mechanism of our body, is activated by an exhale. So, you know, you inhale and you sort of wake yourself up, you liven yourself, you exhale and you calm yourself down. And even just knowing that, you're doing like a 4-8. So breathe in for 4, out for 8. You're immediately starting to reduce stress in the body. We know when we're panicking that our breathing becomes very shallow, and often we hold our breath, which can often lead to feeling dizzy or faint or, you know, all those sorts of feelings as well. So again, as soon as we notice that, you start to get that breathing nice and deep again, and you immediately start to calm down.
Yeah, absolutely. And researching it this morning, there was so much information. So it's absolutely delightful to write this article, I must admit. Anyway, I've deflected this slightly. So... Fran, quick question as well. Do you see children, adolescents, adults? What's your age group?
Adolescents and adults. So I sort of work sort of 13 and upwards generally.
And also, you know, adolescents come across you with a whole range of, you know, anxieties now. Having done acne clinics, you know, you do see a lot of adolescents that are so struggling. Obviously, in their case, maybe with their appearance, but they've got, you know, they've got exams, they've got stress. They suddenly have to make life career choices at, you know, 16, 17. They've got maybe, you know, not great relationships with parents. They've got, you know, relationships with boys, girls, you know. It's just a minefield of what they have to deal with, and social media just adds, you know, the icing on the cake with that one. How do you find with adolescents? Do you have to maybe engage them slightly different to an adult, or is it just the individual in front of you that you see the differences with?
Yeah, so again, you know, it is obviously the individual that you're working with. With adolescents, you often find that actually they're much more malleable, that the whatever they're kind of wherever they're at is actually still quite new and quite fresh. So you often find that they are very open to change, to thinking and feeling slightly differently, sort of slightly more quickly often. But you're right, there's a huge amount more for them to be anxious about, and it ends up kind of really, really scattering into all areas, from, you know, the world ending to yes which must be terrifying to experience.
It is. I mean, it is. It's your heart goes out to, you know, these adolescents in front of you. It's very, very difficult. And like you say, though, they're young, and hopefully there's processes in place that can make a massive difference as well. Question as well, do you see people that are on medication that have been to the GP maybe and been prescribed medications, so sertraline or other medications?
Yeah, very often. Yes, people often come in. People often want to try talking therapy before they go on a medication, but often as well they come in when they're already on it. It really varies. It's not for me to ever recommend or suggest whether they do or don't. It's entirely up to them if they want to.
Absolutely. And when you've seen your clients as well, you've built up that, you know, you've assessed them, you set maybe something in place. So maybe for myself, maybe I'm interested in breath work. Would you provide the education on that and maybe a series of, you know, lesson? How does it work? Yeah. How do I do it?
Yeah, so I use other people a lot. So there's a lovely 40-day meditation course, which is free online, with two teachers called Jack Cornfield and Tara Brack, and they're fantastic. And it's a 40-day, 10-minute-a-day mindfulness training that I will send out to clients. But there's also loads of amazing breath works. We've got brilliant apps, Insight Timer, Calm, there's quite a few of them out there that all have enough free options on there that people can access different breath works. I also send out talks. I'm quite a big fan of TED Talks, but also just people speaking about stuff. But I always make it very clear to clients that this is information. They don't have to watch it. They may find someone else more helpful, but it's just, I think the more they hear it being spoken about from different people, the more likely it is to kind of sink in. So I do use a lot of different tools and breath works online.
Absolutely. And I think that's really useful to hear that as a you know, healthcare professional, because we do, that's what we have to do. You know, we have to basically signpost quite a lot because, you know, none of us are experts in everything. And also we've only got 20 minutes to see a patient. So the fact is that, you know, we need to signpost, and very importantly, what you mentioned there, the free, you know, what we can provide free, yeah. Because with cost of living, et cetera, it's very difficult. So, yeah, this amazing class and it'll cost you da, da, da. So it's really important to have that. And I must admit, I think as a healthcare professional working in the NHS, it's really important to have your sort of, you know, signposting already there. So you've got all your different signposting for different reasons, and then you can discuss it on the day if you wish. So it's really good to have that. So how often do you see your clients, or does it vary again? And how many times do they roughly see you?
So that varies. I offer open-ended. Generally, it's weekly, once a week. For lots of people, again, cost of living, it ends up being fortnightly. I wouldn't do less than that, just simply because the flow, you lose the momentum. Ideally, weekly, because you can get a really good bit of momentum going there. And it really does vary length of time. For some people, it could be 3 to 6 months. For others, a lot longer. But it depends on what you're working with. I've had clients for sort of several years at a time. But I'd say, 50-60% probably, you know, a year to 18 months.
And you can understand, Fran, you know, people will become, you know, they'll have that rapport with you and the confidence in speaking openly with you as well, how they're feeling. And that, you know, that's reflection on yourself, because, you know, it's building up that relationship, isn't it, with that client, and, you know, helping them and have that, giving that client the confidence to actually, you know, express their feelings, which we know not everybody is very good at sometimes. So, yeah, you're a natural, definitely are a natural. We've mentioned breath work, and we've mentioned some mindfulness there as well. Is there anything else, Fran, that you would suggest in your appointments when it comes to anxiety?
Well, so self-care is another big area of interest for me, and something that I've been sort of looking at for many years. And I have a twin, co-wrote a little self-published book on self-care called The Mind Diet. And we looked at all the different ways that you can nourish your mind. And so I encourage clients to create one for themselves. And we look at, you know, interconnectedness. So the quality of the relationships around you, but also how you engage in those relationships. Are you walking and talking on the phone, or is it when you're driving somewhere, or do you actually stop and sit and listen? Nature, obviously a lovely one. Yeah. You know, at this time of year, it's perfect. You can walk barefoot in a park, or, you know, forest bathing. I'm a big fan of ice baths in rivers.
Yeah, same.
Yeah. Wonderful for your mental health. And it's not just the swimming, it's the group activity as well. So I look at all areas of their life. I mean, it includes diet, it includes exercise, it includes sleep hygiene, it includes all these different things. So we look at all areas and we see, what is it that you're doing right now that is nourishing you? Because I think about we all have a coping cup, and that cup gets used up. And depending on what's going on in our life, you know, if that cup is at the bottom, if it's in the dregs, we need to know how to replenish it. You know, and we know when that cup is emptied, because you find you withdraw from others, you cease to have availability for people who are struggling, or even going out and socializing and things. You know, we become much more tearful. So there's all these little alarm bells that go off. So what are we doing to replenish that cup? And it would be interconnectedness. It would be, you know, gratitude list is a lovely one. There's a lovely thing you can do with a gratitude jar, actually. If there's a few of you, you can have a jar in the middle of the house. And then each day or each week, someone pops in something just saying, I'm grateful for. And at the end of the month, you all sit down and read them together. And there's something about that little jar filling up with gratitude that you can see, but also then being able to share it with each other. So there's all these little kind of techniques and tools that we can use. And then there's things like a lovely bath, you know, a relaxing bath with candles and Epsom salts. There's, you know, doing yourself a manicure pedicure if you're into that. There's, you know, all these different things, again, which we kind of see as indulgences. And it's actually, I see self-compassion in action.
It's so important, isn't it? And a lot of those you've mentioned just now are free, and yes, you can do them.
Exactly.
You know,
exactly.
Set time for me time and have that bath, or, you know, go and walk barefooted in a forest. It's all these things. It's what makes you a person, isn't it? And, you know, how you cope. And, you know, everybody has bad days, everybody has good days, but it's really important, you know, to have that me time and self-care. And I love the mind diet. Was that the right words?
Yes.
Yeah, that's great. That's fantastic. And you also mentioned sleep hygiene as well, which I'm a big believer of. Could you just explain to our listeners a bit more about sleep hygiene for people that maybe have not really heard about sleep hygiene?
Yes, absolutely. So we're really looking at what it is that you're doing the hour or two before you go to bed. And ideally, I sort of think the hour before, at least, you really want to be ready for bed. So cleansed and toned, if that's what you do, teeth cleaned as well, if possible, in PJs would be great, bath and showers. And for that last hour, you really, really want to be reducing or stopping screen time. The lighting wants to be a little bit dimmer. You can be in your bedroom, but it doesn't have to be in the bedroom, but somewhere where you're comfortable. Really, really just quietening things down. What do you do when you get into bed? Where is your phone? Are you scrolling before you turn your light out? Is your phone on do not disturb, or is it on so it can still ping notifications at you through the night? Do you have bright lights in the room? You know, how all these different things. What's the temperature like? What are you sleeping in? What are the sheets like? If you do wake up in the night and you're struggling to get back to sleep, don't stay in bed. You know, they say after about 20-25 minutes, if you're still lying in bed, get up, put yourself somewhere else. Again, you know, keep the lighting nice and low, find a book or a magazine, something that doesn't involve looking at your screen, and just spend 15-20 minutes just relaxing somewhere, and then put yourself back to bed. I don't think there's anything wrong with an audiobook or a meditation if you're going to sleep, just to kind of stop your mind from chattering if you're finding that difficult. You can, again, put those on timers. You don't have to have those on all night. So there's lots of different things that you want to be looking at. Obviously, no caffeinated drinks before bed, that type of thing, but yeah.
Yeah, no, it does make a difference. And I think it is. It's like stripping it all back, really, isn't it? And, you know, taking time for yourself, you know, put your PJs on and just chill and, you know, definitely just relax down. And it does make a big difference. And I am religious now at turning my phone off, do not disturb. You know, that's a big one for me. Because before it would be ping, 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 whatever comes up, isn't it? And I just, yeah.
And then it flashes in the dark and you can't look or spot
absolutely.
It.
Absolutely.
But also we are kind of consciously, unconsciously alert to our phones at all times. And so if it's near you and it's not on do not disturb, then whether you realise it or not, some part of you is still alert and awake to it.
Absolutely. And that's what you see people doing, isn't it? Grabbing for the phone straight away and having that dependence on the phones as well. Definitely. So you've talked quite a lot about, Fran, about, you know, the anxiety and, you know, coping mechanisms and self-care and, you know, really good advice on self-care, which is fantastic, which everyone can take on board, you know, people with or without anxiety, without a doubt. So I just would like you to sort of say some keywords on, for example, as nurses, which are mainly the listeners on this podcast today, would you have any sort of words of wisdom to say to for our nurses out there? First of all, for the patients, if a patient is obviously anxious and not coping very well, and also the second part of this question is for them. You know, what's the words of advice for looking after themselves as well?
Well, first of all, talk to someone. Anxiety can often come with a lot of shame, and people don't want to admit to what they're afraid of, or they think they can handle it, or they try and tackle it on their own. And, you know, trying to calm an anxious mind with an anxious mind is a sort of losing battle. So immediately the first thing is to sort of talk to someone. And then after that, it's really, really being... I think self-compassion is key. I think it's key for everybody across the board, but certainly with anxiety, because with anxiety often comes quite a nasty inner critic that then tells you off for being afraid or tells you off for being pathetic. It uses quite cruel, nasty words. And so recognizing that and being able to learn to self-soothe, I think, is a really, really key part of any type of recovery.
Absolutely. Self-soothing and recognizing and talking is so important, isn't it? Do you find a mixture, Fran, of, I know this is a bit possibly not right to say at present times, but differences between males and females, do you still see the differences, like men not opening up as much as to you? Or do you feel that they open up really well now?
You know what? It's interesting. I remember quite an influx of men coming into therapy around the time Prince Harry opened up about going to therapy when his mother died. And I really noticed an influx then, and it's luckily stayed pretty high. I personally find in my work that men and women open up fairly equally. Men tend to go more linear. Yeah. We tend to sort of look at lots more things en route, should we say. So they're slightly different in the way that they work in that respect. But that's obviously not a hard and fast rule. Everybody is different.
Absolutely. And it's that women multitasking, isn't it? It's all that brain, whereas men definitely are more linear, as you described there. But I, as a nurse as well, I do find that men are really opening up more. I think even post-COVID, men are talking a lot more. And this is sometimes young men as well, you know, opening up about their feelings and their anxieties. And I think that's really refreshing as a nurse to have that experience because, you know, I'm not going to get rid of their anxiety but at least it's something. I feel that when a patient leaves my room that, you know, they've actually talked about it, and it's such a big step, isn't it? Just talking is massive.
Yes. People don't realize the benefit actually of just talking. They can't see the sense in it. And often people say, I don't understand talking therapy. Why would you talk about your problems? And then as soon as they do, they realize, okay. I mean, sometimes just being heard, just feeling heard is enough to alleviate some of the sort of lighter things.
Absolutely, it is. It's so important. And I think as well, you know, it's lightening the load, isn't it? Just speaking to somebody, it does make a big difference. And can I ask, do you ever get patients that, I mean, this is escalating it way up, but do you ever get patients that are expressing, you know, possible self-harm or, you know, the suicide ideation? Do you ever get to that level with clients that you see? Yeah.
Yes. Sadly, you know, that's sort of part of the job. And we have, you know, protocols in place on how to kind of work with that depending on the client. Yes, I don't know how much detail you want me to go into on that, but
it's something we often speak about now, suicide ideation, because it's something we have to be, I think it, there's still that feeling when nurses are in doubt of asking the question, because the fact is that, you know, they feel that, you know, it's going to make that person go off and do the deed kind of thing, which is not true.
Absolutely.
Yeah, but it's how that person then feels that they are not qualified to deal with it, or they're concerned, and how to escalate it. So, I mean, how do you go about it if a person is really, really, really distressed and actually expressing suicide ideation? Just in a nutshell, you don't have to go into massive detail.
I mean, suicidal ideation is actually far more common, I think, than we realise. There's a point when we become more concerned, thinking about not wanting to live, thinking about wanting to die is a relatively common thought that we have when we're in stress. It doesn't necessarily lead to suicide, but when we start to make plans, when we start to believe that we're a burden to others, that people will be better off without us, those are the sort of big alarm bells that we start to kind of, as a therapist, pick up on and notice. And then we put sort of, you know, sort of more serious plans in place. We certainly get in touch with the GP with the client's permission. If anything was to happen in session where I felt I was worried, I would personally escort that person to an A&E department. But again, all of this is done with the client's permission.
Absolutely. And that's something we would do in the hospital as well, and have done in the hospital, you know, because if they're in danger, they're putting you in danger possibly as well. And in fact, that they're in danger. And, you know, sometimes they may have a support worker. So it's the basic questions, isn't it? Sometimes asking those as well. But always, and this is what I do harp on about, always have a support mechanism in place. So if this does happen in your consultation, you know how to escalate it, definitely. And I think it's something we commonly are asking now, you know, definitely it's, you know, it's a question that we often ask. And again, it's probably because sometimes the medication that they're going on, but also the fact is that people are being more open about their feelings. And, you know, it's quite common to have anxiety and depression as well.
Yes, it is. Yeah.
So we've talked a lot about anxiety. You've come up with some absolutely great words about explaining it all. I still love that. I think it's fantastic. And the fact is, you know, we've got some aspects of care that we can provide as well, and also looking after ourselves. I just want to say, Fran, a massive thank you for this podcast. I honestly could speak to you all day. Are there any sort of advice you would say to our listeners, to, you know, any really great sort of signposting tools or any fantastic work that you've done where you could signpost? For example, you've already mentioned some of the work that you've done. Is there anything that you would be able to signpost to our listeners today?
Oh, let me have a think. I mean, I do quite a lot of writing, and I'm doing some writing at the moment around anxiety. And if you go on my website, then there's some of the articles I've written. But with respect to anxiety, you know, it really is, there's huge amounts of information out there, and it really is finding what works for you. You know, every therapist is different, every approach is different. I've sort of come up with my own kind of eclectic mix of things that I've kind of pulled together. So, yeah, as I said, really, it's just about talking up to people about it. You know, as I said, it comes with a lot of shame often. And shame is a sneaky little sucker.
Yes, and, it is indeed.
Yes, and it keeps us quiet. It keeps us hidden. So, you know, as soon as we open up about it, then the sooner we can start to get the support that we need.
Absolutely. And I agree that people are ashamed about saying it, you know, oh, I've had anxiety, or I do suffer from anxiety or depression. I say, oh, yeah, that's, you know, loads of people have it, you know, and they suddenly you see this, whew, you know, you're not the only one out there that's got anxiety or depression. That's good. Absolutely. Yes.
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's really good to be open about it as well. What we will do on the podcast, if there is any links, we will definitely put some links associated with this podcast. I hope this is not the last we hear from Fran, because she's an absolutely fantastic clinician. And I love the way you're just so passionate about what you do, and also the way you explain everything as well is just phenomenal. So on behalf of the BDNG, I would really like to say a massive thank you. And you've got a sparkling career ahead of you, definitely.
Thank you very much for having me, Tina. I really, really enjoyed this. So thank you.
Oh, pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. I hope you enjoyed this episode. For further information on the BDNG, visit our website, bdng.org.uk, and watch out for the next BDNG podcast, which is coming soon.